Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight in this beautiful night, Chicagoland area. We broadcast 18 stories above the mouth of the Chicago River in this beautiful town, city of Chicago. We're going to learn a little bit about its history tonight with John Schmidt, Chicago historian. He's got a new book out called Hidden Chicago Landmarks. And it's going to start a series that we're putting together where we go to the hidden Chicago landmarks. Talk with John about their significance. Tonight we start with the downtown cow path. This is fascinating, and I was talking a little bit about that, but the cow path in the loop. You wouldn't think that there'd be remnants of any cow paths anywhere near the bustling skyscrapers in the loop, especially on Monroe Street, but that's not the case. We go there today, and we will broadcast that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. We're also going to continue our Chicago neighborhood tour. Tonight, the South Loop. We go over to Akira's, Praline Candies, shop at 18th in the 1845 South State with Marge Halperin to talk about the neighborhood that is at the same time new and old. South Loop, of course, is a burgeoning new development in the city of Chicago. It's been the last 15, 20 years. It's exploded. But the South Loop in general, if you look at its boundaries and its parameters, that's some of Chicago's greatest history. You think about Al Capone, and you think about all the vice that was down in that area at the time. You think about all the institutions that are down there. There's so much that is actually in the South Loop before it was called the South Loop. So we'll talk with Marge about her neighborhood coming up in the 8 o'clock hour as well. I'm looking forward to this, and I'm proud to say that Adam Hoge, WGN Radio's Bears aficionado, I mean, really, truly, one of the best Bears beat reporters in the city, is coming on tonight to talk about, to sort of preview the preseason. It starts tomorrow, and also kind of wrap up his thoughts on Bears camp, what he saw. But he is joining us on Monday nights on Extension 720 coming up this fall for our Monday evening quarterback. If you were an avid listener to The Download, we did this segment with him when the Bears weren't any good. That was the downside. We were talking about John Fox and what was going wrong, so it was just me complaining and Adam backing that up. Last year, we were on the Steve Cochran show. There was no, we were not at nights for a Monday evening anything. And so Adam returns as we return to the nights, Monday nights, 8 o'clock. How great is that? That's like a traditional spot to talk Bears football. And have Adam Hoge, one of the best, who by that point of after a Sunday game, has already dissected the film, been able to be up at Hallis Hall, do all the great work that he usually does. To be able to bring that, all that insight to us right away on Monday night, I think that's great. I grew up in Chicago listening to the 8 o'clock. I just think about my young adult life with a Doug Buffone, right? And, of course, OB. Those guys doing a Monday night. There was obviously the post after the games, but they would do the Monday night, and you might get a Hubarkish in there. Just taking calls and talking about what they saw and getting a little bit more depth. And that's what we're going to get with Adam. I always, always, always appreciate having Adam Hoge on the program. He's such a delight, but he's also just a fountain of knowledge. So Adam Hoge on the Bears preseason and what he saw from Bears camp. A lot of great insights you can also find at WGNradio.com/Bears, where all his stuff is at. So that's coming up as well. Now, we're also going to talk about the business. We're downloading Chicago business, but we'll talk about the business of water parks. What a perfect time. What a great summer Chicago business. Open a water park. It's got to be one of the most difficult things to do. And the fact that you have, what, 2 serviceable months to make your to make what you need to do to make your money. 2. I mean, it's not like you start in April. Oh yeah, it's so fun. Come on out. Even May and June have changed drastically in terms of what you can expect from the weather. You really have from where we're at right now to Labor Day, maybe into September, to make money if you're a water park. But that's what they're doing out at Raging Waves in Yorkville. So we'll talk about that coming up with the owner of the water park. It was a fun way. I like that. I like that. I feel like that's a good way to expand our business conversations, because you don't really think about the business of water parks. You just think about the water park. If the wave pool's any good. Pete, are you a wave pool guy? I don't see you as a wave pool guy.
No, I'm not. I'm not a water park person per se, I guess.
Right.
In that I'll go buy one, you'll see one, or you'll see something on TV, and I'm like, man, that looks amazing. I want to just dive in, get wet.
I don't feel like Chicago is much of a water park culture. You know, I know there's going to be some locations in the area, and I remember as a kid we would go to Cherry Valley Mall, or right around Cherry Valley Mall they had one. Forgot the name of it. Out by Rockford. And then there was, of course, the Dells, right? And, of course, Great America has the mm-hmm. water park side of it. But I don't feel like you see water parks, you know, on every street corner like a Starbucks here.
I generally like to stay away from areas where kids are in water.
Yeah.
Just always concerned about it.
Too many Band-Aids.
Right. And even like at Great America, you know, riding the log ride. Do they still have the log ride in the boats?
You sit down and right away your bottom is all soggy. You're like, oh, that's the water park.
There's nothing
worse than being the one guy in the water ride that's the spinning, the one that's, I don't know the names of them, but that's all the, it's like the new, it's been the last 15 years, 20 years.
It's like your whitewater rampage or whatever.
Yeah. And you'd be the one guy where the wave actually hits you and you get off of that thing and everyone's waiting in line and maybe it's a little colder day at Great America. And it's just like you're soaked from top to bottom. There's nothing worse. I was thinking about, I think it's next weekend that the new Danny McBride show comes out on HBO. The one where he plays the evangelical son who's trying to take over from his dad, who's John Gooden. It looks great. Yeah. But there's a great scene in the trailer where they try to do a mass baptism in a wave pool, but somebody turns on the waves. So everybody's in there, and Danny McBride is like doing a mass baptism, and someone turns the waves on. So everyone's like trying to get... That's a great idea. All right, so all that's coming up tonight here on Extension 720. We've got a great show in and out of studio, so we're going to get to it here. Pete Zimmerman, of course, Don Kleppen as well. And we'll continue to broadcast till 10 o'clock tonight, 312-981-7200. We'll take our first break, come back, and get ready for Adam Hoge at 7:30. Stay with us. Got a little impression on this promo, too, because it says it's a matinee matchup as Anderson and the Sox look to tame the Tigers. Tim Anderson's day 4-for-4. Got on base 5 times. Learned that from listening to Kevin Powell today during the Rokan show. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 7:30, Adam Hoge's going to join us right after the news to talk about what his thoughts about Bears camp. He writes up these great posts. There's some of the best. There is just, as a Bears fan, and I think, you know, many people listening to this radio station right now fall into the same category. We're all, there's not enough to read. I can find myself all the time being like, it's not really feeling it from the Trib or the Sun Times. I'm like, where do you go after that? And I feel that Adam does the stuff he puts on GN, and I'm not the only one, because I feel like the national media picks it up. There's, we'll be watching Sunday Night Football, and Adam Hoge tweets get retweeted.
Yeah.
And it is, he has definitely found, he's really carved out a niche as a go-to for Bears insight. So I'm just happy that he gives us the time of day.
Yeah, his 10 Bears things are a must-read. Yeah. I usually, if I'm going outside, I'll read like the first 10 sentences of The Athletic until I have to pay.
Right, The Athletic.
And then I kind of think of like, I wonder what he's going to say next.
You just guess. You're like, I got it. I think the papers are getting pretty savvy, too. I think that the more the national papers, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, sometimes when I'm on a device and it says you're at your limit, you're just hoping to get a little feel for what the article is in the first paragraph. And the first paragraph couldn't be more generic. Today, in a press conference that happened today, you'll never guess what... Keep reading kind of thing. So,
well, and I got, you know, I subscribed to a few papers, including the Trib, and I got a thing from my bank saying, hey, Tribune's charging you $12 this month. The last month they charged you $8.
Didn't even tell you?
Didn't. I'm like, I'm sure I agree to it. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know it.
There's a lot of great jokes right there. Just right away when you're like, my bank called me about this subscription to the Tribune. You know, I feel like a Henny Youngman or a Johnny Carson. So I got a thing from the bank saying that my that the Tribune is charging more than I thought. They said it was a scam. Sometimes when you read the articles, I agree. You know, something like that. No, that's funny. There's actually, the Reader is doing a telethon coming up on the 23rd. I just flashed on my social media today that they are doing a telethon to raise money for past and current journalists. How great is that? So we'll talk about that coming up in a little bit. Magic Waters was the place that I was trying to remember from Rockford. Thank you to the listeners who text in to say, Magic Waters! How could you forget Magic Waters? In Cherry Valley. I got the Cherry Valley part right. So that's always good. Yeah, so we Pete and I have been we haven't been on the air much in the last week plus because of White Sox games, and they've been kind of roaring with night games. So they had a day game today. They got a day off tomorrow, so we'll be back tomorrow. But we have been all crisscrossing all over the city. Tonight, of course, we're going to talk about Chicago history, talk about the South Loop. We're working on some projects that are we're working on a non sort of fighting violence program in back of the yards, down like 51st and Troop. It's a tremendous program. We're going to talk more about that. I'm going to actually yank some of that stuff because we were out there all day yesterday and play some of it for you tomorrow because it's really powerful to hear, not just from the people who are trying to make a difference in that neighborhood, but from the kids that live in that neighborhood. And it's really some great stuff. And we're putting together a big show that'll be broadcast in September. It'll be like a 3-hour show. It's going to take a little bit of time to put together, but it's really, really good stuff. And I was really blown away by everybody that was down in back of the yard yesterday that we had a chance to talk to. Also, we're up in Skokie today talking about early education, whether or not this idea of getting everybody involved in pre-K starts at birth as opposed to in the belly. This concept of does the United States of America need to move into a new system in which school starts earlier? We'll have that conversation as well. So we're kind of crisscrossing all over the place. Like I said, starting a new series with John Schmidt where we go to all the different landmarks that are in his book and talk specifically about each one by one. So it's going to be a hectic. I'm glad that the White Sox play sometimes at night. It gives us a chance to actually go and do some stuff outside of the studio. So look for that coming up on Extension 720. We got a couple shows this week. We'll air that stuff and shows coming up in the next month. All right, all that coming up here on Extension 720. But Adam Hoge, right after the news, so stay with us. Thanks, Don. Extension 720, 720 WGN. Hard to believe we're back. That season is back. The Chicago Bears start their preseason tomorrow night at Soldier Field against the Carolina Panthers and Ron Rivera. Adam Hoge has been covering the Bears and Bourbonnais for the entire camp, and he has some thoughts on what he saw there and what we can expect from the beginning of the preseason. Adam Hoge, of course, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You can find it all at WGNradio.com/Bears. Adam, thanks for joining us, bud.
Good to be talking Bears with you once again, yes. Buddy. This is going to be a fun year.
It really is. For you to be in Bourbonnais, you know, last year it's unfair to maybe say what were the differences just because last year was a brand new regime. You're getting used to how Matt Nagy ran camp. But can you notice a difference between the team that was there last year and the team that you just saw this year?
Yeah, I think definitely on both sides of the football. First of all, defensively, they've done it now. You know, last year was a lot about taking the next step. They knew the talent was there, but they still had to prove it. They had already been pretty good, but they went from good to great, right? So now they're confident on that side of the football, but they're more experienced. And that really comes through in the practices to me, how knowledgeable these defenders are. And even to the point where, you know, Mitch Trubisky made the comment the other day that it's like they're cheating. Well, in some ways they are, because they've actually gotten to know Matt Nagy's offense so well.
Yeah, right.
By going up against it every day. And Ryan Pace said to me the other day when he was on our podcast that these defensive players are just so smart that they figured out this offense, so they're jumping balls that, you know, otherwise they probably couldn't even do during the regular season. And so that comes through on the defensive side of the football. And then offensively, you know, it's been up and down, I think, in the it's not a surprise that the defense is winning training camp. They should. They're better. But what I've noticed with the offense is everybody looks more comfortable, whether I'm talking about Mitch Trubisky, who's been up and down, but he looks comfortable running the offense, which I think is a key point. Allen Robinson looks more comfortable, more confident coming off last year. He's still coming back from the ACL, so now he's healthier. Everyone in this system looks more comfortable. So as much as this offense has been hyper-analyzed, which tends to happen on good teams in training camp and even bad teams in training camp, I see how they're comfortable, and I think that's a really good sign on the offensive side of the football.
You know what? This is because we're a Chicago football town and we're football fans. We'll start with the defense. Let's go back to the offense. We'll put a pin in the offense. But with Chuck Pagano coming in to replace Vic Fangio, and obviously the first camp that we get to see Khalil Mack and Roquan Smith for that. Remember, he held out last year. Is it a seamless transition with the new defensive coordinator? Are you seeing different wrinkles in what this defense could bring to the regular season?
Well, first of all, I arrived in Bourbonnais thinking that, you know, so far we had kind of underrated the coordinator change, and I was actually expecting to see some hiccups here and there, and maybe we still will once the game starts, but, Vic Fangio was a really good coach who built this, had a huge part in building the defense. Ryan Pace drafted the players, but Fangio really built the system, built the players in the system, and so even though this is a good situation going from Vic Fangio to Chuck Pagano, who's not changing too much, I was still thinking, come on, there's going to be some hiccups here. There has to be. You're losing a coach as good as Vic Fangio. And so far to this point, I haven't seen it on the practice field. They look like they're humming. I mean, they are locked in. The talent's all still there. The chemistry is all still there. And I think there's been some new wrinkles here and there that I'm really can't get into because of their practice rules and not wanting to give away scheme. But every once in a while here and there, I might see a blitz that's different or the way that they're moving a certain player around. But overall, you know, Vic Fangio was already very creative in how he moved pieces around and moved Khalil Mack around and moved Leonard Floyd around from going into coverage and maybe sometimes having them rush on the same side together. That's all going to continue, I think, under Chuck Pagano. And I'm very encouraged with what I've seen so far.
And, you know, as much as you talk about the defense catching up to Matt Nagy's offense and figuring out what they're doing, I would think that the NFL has tape on all of what the Bears were doing defensively last year and are looking forward to attack, especially teams in the NFC North. So having a new defensive coordinator who might actually scheme a little bit differently and maybe hide the bells and whistles a little bit has to be a plus for this defense to return.
You know, that's a good point. I haven't really thought about it like that, but you're not wrong. I mean, having new wrinkles is not a bad thing sometimes because you're right. I mean, the tape is out. It's interesting. You know, tomorrow night's opponent, the Carolina Panthers, Ron Rivera is their head coach. He's now been there. This is his ninth season. Of course, used to be the Bears defensive coordinator when they went to the Super Bowl under Lovie Smith. And I wrote about today in my 10 Bears Things column how part of the reason Ron Rivera's been around the league so long and is such a good coach is he's not afraid to adapt. Other coaches are afraid to adapt. They stick to what works, and eventually the league passes them by.
John Fox.
Yeah. Right, I think it happened with John Fox. I think it happened to Lovie Smith, too, a little bit.
Yeah.
Ron Rivera, when he left the Bears, which was, you know, Tampa 2, 4-3 defense, when he went to San Diego, they were running a 3-4. So then he had the number one defense in a 3-4. He goes to Carolina, gets that job. Well, their personnel was better suited to a 4-3, so he goes back to a 4-3. He's not married to his own ways. He's willing to adapt. And this year, we're going to see it tomorrow night for the first time, the Panthers are actually going back to a 3-4. And part of that reasoning from the research I did and what has been some of the reporting coming out of Carolina is that he felt like the scheme had been the same for so long that opposing offenses knew what they were doing last year, especially late in the year when the Panthers slid out of playoff contention. And so that's a team right there that's willing to adapt. And I think the Bears, to a certain extent, will benefit from that a little bit this year in changing some things here and there.
Yeah.
What I will also say, though, talent wins out. And as long as the Bears are healthy, they're stacked across the board defensively, and they're still going to be really good.
The defensive names, you know, across the board, Khalil Mack and Danny Trevathan and Akeem Hicks, and you could keep going, and Leonard Floyd, they're all coming back. There's really only a couple of positions that you may see new names. Ha-Ha Clinton Dix comes in at safety. There may be a new nickel corner. Are those names blending in? Is it seamless for the new names that are coming on this defense?
Well, the theory with both of those guys, and HaHa Clinton Dix and Buster Skrine, who came in over from the Jets, is that, look, both of them had their struggles at times. It was interesting how HaHa Clinton Dix had to sign a one-year type prove-it deal when he was actually a pretty good safety coming out of Alabama and had a good start with the Packers in his first couple of years and sort of fell out of favor as the defense kind of got worse, right? So, and same thing with Buster Skrine. I think the Bears like his tenacity, and I think that they look at him as a guy who can blitz from that nickel spot. And both of these guys should benefit from playing in a better defense with better talent around them. That's the theory, and I think it will work. I mean, that's how it works a lot of times in the NFL. I mean,
right.
not every player is perfect, and you know, just like the Bears secondary looked a lot better last year because Khalil Mack was in the quarterback's face all year.
Right. It makes
that's certainly a part of the equation.
Right.
So I think those guys are going to be just fine. And then the other person I still consider sort of an addition to the defense this year, because I just think he's going to be so much better in year two. Not that he was bad at all in year one, but that's Roquan Smith.
Yes.
I have incredibly high hopes for this kid, and I really think he could be an all pro maybe as soon as 6 months from now. And that's a big statement for me to make, but I really think he can be that good. And so for him to do that, it would be a huge step up in the middle of that defense, and it would really be like another addition, another all pro, which is scary to think about.
That is scary to think about. Adam Hoge, of course, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You can find it at WGNradio.com/Bears. Also does the Hoge and Johns podcast, wildly successful across the board. Everybody wants a piece of Adam Hoge. All right, Adam, we'll take a quick break, come back, then we're talking Mitch Trubisky in the offense. Can you hang on?
Sounds good.
All right, stay with us. They're the monsters of the Midwest, rolling across the USA. Extension 720 here, talking Bears. We get ready for the preseason. Adam Hoge joins us, WGNradio.com/Bears. Adam, as we continue, before we get to Mitch Trubisky, you know, I hesitate because I didn't really want to talk kickers because I'm already sick of that storyline. But the special teams in general, last year's kickoff return team was not the best. Tariq Cohen did a good job at returning punts. But as a kickoff squad in general, they were terrible. Cordell Patterson comes over from the Patriots, who ran one back against us. How is that unit looking, beyond just the kicker, but how is the special teams unit looking in camp?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one of those things that's kind of hard to actually see in these practices. You sort of have to wait till the games play out to really get an idea of, for instance, how the returns are going to look. What I will say is, I think they're much better shape. Cordero Patterson is a legitimate NFL kick returner, an immediate upgrade, and he's somebody that you probably remember returned a kick for a touchdown against the Bears last year at Soldier Field when the Patriots were in town.
So they also blocked a punt in that game and brought it back. So you got an idea that special teams kind of blew that game. Anyway, go ahead.
Right, and that's a great point because that's one of the losses, one of the four losses from the regular season, and it really did come down to special teams in that game because the final play of the game was a Hail Mary at the 1 yard line. The Bears almost got in there, but it never would have come down to that had they not given up two special teams touchdowns. So it was huge, and that's the other side of this. While I do think the kick return game will be better, and that will help the offense, that will help Mitch Trubisky. That was one of the things working against the offense last year. Let's also not forget they lost Josh Bellamy. Sam Acho's not here anymore, although he was hurt last year for most of the season. Benny Cunningham is no longer here. So they did lose some key pieces, some good special teamers. They retained Ben Broniker. I think Sherrick McManus still has a good chance to make this team, although that's an interesting experiment because they're trying to move him to be a backup safety now. And if he can prove to do that, he will make the team. He is such a good special teamer. So there are new pieces here that are going to be filled in from more of the blocking standpoint and some of the things you don't always think about as a fan. But overall, I do think the kick return game will be better. It should be an upgrade. And if it is, that'll help the offense a lot.
Okay, so all of the hubbub, whether it be in sports talk or even the national media getting involved, has been surrounding Mitch Trubisky's roller coaster of a camp. He's thrown a ton of interceptions where, you know, Tom Brady threw his first one, you know, like this today or whatever it is. But there's a head scratch to why he's throwing so many interceptions. Some pushback is like, well, the defense is much better here in Chicago, and of course they know the offensive scheme. But what do you see from Mitch Trubisky? Should we be worried as fans about throwing interceptions at camp?
I'm not worried. I mean, there have been a throw here or there where it's clearly in the double coverage, and I'm like, all right, that was a bad decision. But, you know, the coaches have come back and said, well, look, sometimes out here in camp, those are the throws you're going to try to make right now to see if you can do it. And you're going to take those chances, whereas in a game, we don't want him doing that. So get him out of your system now, and that's part of the learning process. So if you buy into that, if you buy what the coaches are selling there, then maybe you can get away with it. I'm willing to buy that to a certain extent. I also think that it's fair to say Mitch has made some throws that were not so great in camp, and I think that's fair. You know, this whole idea, okay, Tom Brady didn't throw his first pick until today. All right, that's the greatest quarterback of all time. And there was once, there was just a few years ago, Jay Cutler didn't throw an interception for like his first 11 practices or something like that. So I don't put too much stock in that. What I care about most right now, and what I am 100% buying from the coaches, because I tend to see it too, is he looks comfortable in the system. He looks more comfortable. That goes back to OTAs too. And I think all the pre-snap type things that really matter so much, that are going to allow him to focus more on the opposing defense each week instead of what his own game plan is, because he's already going to know it. I think that that's going to be huge and allow him to have the game slow down more once we get to the regular season. And that's really, to me, the key. If the game slows down for Mitch Trubisky, he's going to be able to go through his reads and make the right throw and make the correct throw and keep the interceptions down. And if he does that, this offense is going to take care of itself, especially if they're able to run the football better this year, which I think they will be able to do.
Well, let's make it true. Before we get to that, I'm fascinated, because I was listening and trying to understand, and I do it through listening to you as well, that, you know, the Matt Nagy's offense is one that's just pretty, you know, people understand how the mechanisms of it, but he does a great job of masking and moving pieces around to see what defense you're playing against the offense. And a lot of that was done to help Mitch Trubisky, who didn't necessarily feel comfortable in the offense. Will this change, as Nagy himself has said in this preseason, that he needs to adapt and change his offense because people are going to catch up to what he was doing last year? It has to start there with Mitch Trubisky not having to essentially have all this pre-snap confusion to understand how the defense play. He needs to do a better job of understanding without all those bells and whistles.
Right, because you're right. I mean, there is going to be an adjustment made, and I think that happened throughout the year too by opposing defenses. They sort of had an idea of what was coming, but this is also an enormous playbook, and not all of it was out there last year. And it's part of the reason why this offense is so hard to learn. And there's so many plays. There's so many variations within plays. Remember, you may remember this from last year, plays on plays. Mm-hmm. That's what Matt Nagy talks about. So you run a successful play early in the game that sets up another successful play from the same exact formation later in the game. So you're constantly keeping the defense guessing. And he's such a good coach, and this is such a good system, that that's still going to be there. As long as Trubisky is executing it and making the right decisions, there's even more weapons for him to go to this year in this offense, and there's always going to be somebody open. It's up to him to make the right read, make the right throw, and make the accurate throw, and if he does that, this offense is going to be fine.
Oh, man. Okay, so we're running out of time, so I'm gonna skip the tight end talk. We'll skip the wide receivers, which is amazing to me, because the year before this, we were talking about how that was the weakest part of this team, and now it's one of the strengths, Allen Robinson getting to full strength. But let's talk about the running back, specifically David Montgomery, the rookie who impressed in camp with a run where he knocked over, I think, 25, 30 Bear defenders. It seemed like he brought the spirit of Walter Payton with him. And that is just, if that is coming to the Bears offense where this kid is hard to take down, I mean, Bears fans are going to get really excited.
Sure, and I'll leave you with a tease since we're short on time, but you can read about that run in my column that's just up today at WGNRadio.com/Bears and see the video too, because it is really impressive. It's probably the best play at camp so far. And you'll also get Ryan Pace's reaction there. But what I'll say is, that single run, everything built up to that run, because it was the first time the Bears went with live tackling. So it was the closest thing to real football with a running back we've seen since he got drafted. And everything they've talked about with David Montgomery, how he has great contact balance, how when he takes a hit, he keeps his balance so he can hit the next guy. And he's just so good at slipping tackles and breaking tackles. It was on display with that run. So it's an incredibly small sample size.
Right.
But I think we're going to see more of him tomorrow night. I think he's one of these guys that's going to play against the Panthers and is one of the reasons why you're still going to want to tune in tomorrow night, even though it is a preseason game.
Fantastic. Adam Hogue covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You can find his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Also, the Hogue and Johns podcast, which is a must-listen when it comes out. Adam, I'm looking forward to this season and talking Bears with you every Monday. Thanks for joining us tonight.
It's going to be great, Justin. Thanks.
From Bears to cows, or to the cow path in the loop, talk a little Chicago history coming up. John Schmidt, he's the author of Hidden Chicago Landmarks. We're going to go down to the old cow path on Monroe, which no longer is in service. But it still stands. It's a little piece of Chicago history that's hidden in the loop, and it's just one of the several instances of Chicago history that is hidden or obstructed from plain view. We will talk with John Schmidt and start our series of looking at some of these hidden Chicago landmarks right after the news here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Don. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, we're going to continue our Chicago neighborhood tour, bring you the South Loop, talk about an area that is, of course, brand new and at the same time, very old. It's like it runs the gamut. That's a massive neighborhood there. So we will talk with Marge Helprin, meet over at Akira's Praline Candy Coffee Shop, bringing New Orleans to the South Loop. Coming up after 8:30 and at 9 o'clock, in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to talk water parks, business of running one, Raging Waves in Yorkville. Talk about how do you make your money when you have essentially the window of, what, 3 weekends in the Chicagoland area. We'll be our guest in the Download in Chicago business. But right now, we start a new series exploring hidden Chicago landmarks. It's all based on the great book that historian John R. Schmidt just put out, called Hidden Chicago Landmarks. In it, he tells the stories of Chicago history, the stories that you don't hear on any tour. That could be anything from who's buried in Logan's tomb to a forgotten home of Clarence Darrow. In our first story tonight, Willard Jones and the Cow Path in the Loop. We go to 100 West Monroe Street to explore. We're standing here in the Loop, a nondescript alleyway, and we're going to get to it in just a moment with Chicago historian John Schmidt, who was once a high school teacher who turned into one of the preeminent voices in Chicago history. He's talking about your new book, Hidden Chicago Landmarks. John, great to see you. Thanks for coming downtown with us today. We want to talk about this. But what was the impetus for doing this book?
Well, about 30 years ago, I bought my first house. Actually, God, 40 years ago, I bought my first house. And I'd already been working on my PhD, and I'd already been teaching history for some years. But when I moved in, after I'd been there for a few weeks, I found out there was this house down the street from me that was a historic landmark, kind of a notorious historic landmark. That kind of started me collecting these things of the hidden parts of Chicago that usually aren't reported, the places you don't get in the usual tour guide, and kind of funky in that way. So that's how I got started.
Well, you know, it is interesting because you're right. There's now it's a cottage industry to have tours of history of Chicago or the architecture.
Yeah,
they're making, you know, worldwide
gangster tours. Yeah.
But when you think about Chicago history, especially where we're standing, there's no plaque, there's no remembrance. People forget.
Well, it used to be a plaque, but it disappeared. But anyway, talking about where we are.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So we are standing right here in a nondescript alleyway in the heart of the Loop, right off of Monroe. Why this spot? What are we talking about today?
Okay, well, we're at the north end over here of a piece of property, actually the west end of a piece of property. You got to go back to 1833 when this was kind of empty farmland and so on, the early years of Chicago. And a man named Willard Jones bought a plot of land from the state of Illinois north of Monroe Street, 90 feet in from Clark Street, and went from Monroe to Madison. And he owned this land, and he conceivably was a farmer there for a few years. And then things get a little involved. After a few years, he sells the southern half of his land to a guy named Barnes. okay? But the Barnes land is only 80 feet wide. There's a 10-foot wide strip at the west end of the property that they keep over there. Willard Jones keeps it there for access to the south. Presumably, he wanted to take his cattle down this 10-foot.
He wanted to take his cows. A cow pass. Yeah,
yeah, there was a cow path. There was, where the Board of Trade is today. That was pasture land. So he keeps this cow path. He keeps this access. Well, a few years later, Willard Jones, being an entrepreneur, he sells off the north part of the land. He sells it off to somebody named Henderson. But written into the deed is that the Henderson and his heirs will continue to have access through this 10-foot wide path going down toward the
And it's amazing to think about, too, because, you know, where we're at, even after the Great Chicago Fire, I mean, they started to build and build and build in this area. To think that Monroe and Clark Street in Chicago, downtown, with all the hotels and everything that's happening downtown and the bustling loop, would actually be a cow pass that would be right in the heart of it. It is big enough, you're right, to be a spot for cattle. Let's walk in. Let's just walk right through here, and you get between these buildings. You can hear how it changes. But this is, you'd have no idea this is here. This is a wide indoor alleyway that is for cattle.
Yeah, originally this was an alley, and this was before the current building built up here. So for many years after the fire and so on, this looked just like an alley. Then in 1926, the people that have the southern property, the successors to the Barnes family, they decide they want to build this 22-story building up here. Well, the people on the northern part, the successors to the Hendersons, they look into their deed and they see, oh, we got this 10-foot wide access to your property.
Right.
You can't build on this access way unless you pay us a huge amount of money. Well, the people on the southern part here that want to build a skyscraper, which was what 22 stories was in those days, they decide, crunch the numbers, then they said, hey, we'll just redesign our building. You know, the heck with you guys. And that's what they did. They just redesigned the building, and now you've got it.
So that goes over it.
Yeah, it goes over the cow path over the building. Actually, it goes over the cow path.
It's an indoor alley.
It's an indoor alley, basically.
It's an indoor alley, wow.
And, you know, this got a lot of press at the time in the 1920s, and it became a big tourist attraction for a while. Mayor Kelly came out here in the 30s. He put a plaque on it. They did the WPA guide to Illinois.
This was a big deal.
It's a great story. And
so what happened, John? I mean, when you talk about hidden Chicago landmarks, we're standing in it. No one's bothering us. It's public property, I guess. But no one from the street. If you're on Monroe Street, you would have no concept that this is here. There are two big black doors. It's nondescript. It looks like it's private. You would have no idea that this is here.
I take exception to that, Justin, because people are going to buy the book, and they're going to look at the book. It's the first story in the book, because that's how it's geographically organized. And they're going to say, wow, let's take a look at the cop app. And I feel sorry for the guy out there who's sitting there collecting for the valet parking for the Hyatt Centric Hotel, which, by the way, we should give them a plug, Hyatt Centric Hotel.
So, John, what happened here? Because you mentioned the plaque, and this was a tourist attraction. Did greed take over? Did we just forget about this crucial moment in Chicago history?
Yeah, basically, people forgot over the time. During the 1970s, when they were building on the north part over here, this came into the news again, and they did a search through the legal books and everything. And during the 1970s, people said, "Well, maybe that cow path proviso in the settlement, maybe that doesn't have any kind of a bearing after all."
Right.
So you know, it was kind of up in the air what's going on.
It's hard to believe there wasn't a legal challenge, but at the time, the buildings around here said, "Well, you know what? There's nothing that stops us from closing this off," and they did it, and there was no legal challenge.
Well, they closed off the north end over here. Now, conceivably, the people that own the building in the north end, they can just get out and they can walk right through here like any other person can. So they still got their access. They just chose to close off their own section.
It's a fascinating spot that we're in, and it's awesome for Chicago history. But this is all of your book, whether you're talking about where you know, Ronald Reagan's home, whether you're talking about landmarks, who's in the Logan's tomb, everything down you could think about.
Oh, you go all over. You get
book.
The Leaning Tower of Niles. We go to the southern part of the city. There's an enchanted lake that many people don't know it's there. But, you know, you drive by. There's a lake out there? Yeah, there is a lake out there. A little lake called Lake Calumet. You know, you see it on old maps, but is Lake Calumet still there? Yeah, most of it's still there, or at least part of it. You know, and there are all kinds of landmarks. Chicago's oldest public monument, right on the border. The Christmas Story House, dip over into Hammond, but that's Chicago Metro. You know, there are a lot of places.
When you're doing this, you know, because a lot of it is like, hey, I remember this place, and I remember this place. But how do you go about researching this? Where do you find all these stories to put into your book?
That's the good thing with going to graduate school and studying for a PhD, particularly at University of Chicago, where they work you hard. You look into old newspaper reporting is the first thing you do. And then you double it up. You look under census records. Like in census records, you could find out where Joe Lewis lived in 1940. That's how I put that. That's how I confirmed that. That's how I confirmed city directories. That's how I confirmed that there's still a house in the city on the south side where Clarence Darrow lived. And that house is still staying. As a matter of fact, they just renovated it a short time ago. So that's what you do. You look into a variety of sources.
Well, the great thing about it, too, because most Chicago historical places are going to be, there's going to be a plaque. There's going to be some sort of designated marker. But a lot of the places in your book, that's gone. It's a bygone era. There's no plaque here that says anything about the cow path on Monroe. There's many of the, like you said, many of the houses. There's nothing that says, you know, this is the house where Carpenter was caught or, you know, all the things that are in your book. So there is something great about trying to collect this stuff. And for the person who is a Chicagoan by heart and loves Chicago history, not a lot of people know about this stuff anymore.
Well, it's Hyatt-centric hotels here seems to know about it. They named one of their conference rooms after Willard Jones, so at least they knew it was his property. And so far, they're not trying to close off the access over here, but I don't know. Maybe if we get a lot of people going through here on tours or something like that, we might get another legal.
They could put
challenge.
A coffee stand right here.
Yeah,
they could
do a lot of things. So
it really is an indoor alley because you've got garbage and some other. You would have no idea the significance of this spot in Chicago's downtown. John Schmidt, the new book is called Hidden Chicago Landmarks, and we're going to continue. We're going to have a series here where we got to go and see a bunch more with you because this is fascinating and this is truly Chicago history, John. Thanks for taking us to the cow path here at 100 West Monroe Street in Chicago.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Great to have John on the program. His book, Hidden Chicago Landmarks, you can find it now. It was put out by the History Press. It's just out now. And like I said, the beginning of a series is we'll take on some more. John will take us to some more Chicago landmarks and Chicago history that you can't find on the tour. We'll do that here on Extension 720 on 720 WGN. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you tonight till 10 o'clock. Along for the ride. Beautiful night as the sun goes down here. And the skyscrapers along the Chicago River. See right out the window, you can see the sun setting beyond where we used to be over at the Tribune Tower. And then you can see the Marriott and the Intercontinental and all the buildings that are lining the river as you get to us here in the 18th floor, 303 Wacker.
I feel since the last time we were here, it's too dark already. Summer's over. You know, getting the feeling like, oh my God, or you know, pretty soon we're going to be doing, it's going to be dark at 4.
You really notice that when you work in the mornings. You know, I felt like in the summertime, when you're in July or August, when we were working on Steve Cochran's show, you would have to wear sunglasses in here when you came in at 6 o'clock in the morning because the sun was already up and bright. And then when you get to a certain spot, and it's even before daylight savings, when you get to the Octobers and even on the other side in the spring, you recognize, you come in here and it is dark. And that is that's what you're talking about. That's you long for those moments. I do this thing with my son. I tell him all the time, and he gets annoyed with me, but I stop, and this is what annoys him. I make it so dramatic. But we'll be walking down the street, right? We'll just walking to wherever we're going, we'll go to Target, something like that. We're walking, and I'll stop him, and I'll grab him by the shoulders. I go, oh, my gosh, do you feel how nice it is right here? It is July, whatever, it is August 8th. Now imagine it's January 8th. Huh? You notice the difference? Remember this moment. And then I do it the other way in January, too. I grab them, I go, with the coats on. I say, you remember how hot it was in August? Remember how cold it is now? Remember this in August. So go back and forth. At first, he's like, what's happening? Is everything okay? And then he's like, ah, come on, Dad. Knock it off. Stop being so obnoxious. Gotta have the little things, right? That's what life is all about, those little things. Of trying to get my son to think of 6 months ago and what it's going to be like 6 months from now. In a very grave, we need to talk. He also is not happy with me. I'm doing a lot of singing. So if I walk into, like, there's a bagel place on the corner, and the bagel places will play all the top 40 stuff. Mostly a nonstop loop cycle of Shawn Mendes songs. Because he seems to be, if you walk through the Pedway, I walked through the Pedway tonight to get dinner. Each place was playing a different version of their top 40, and it was all different Shawn Mendes songs. Like, this is crazy. This guy's probably sitting in his LA hotel right now being like, they're playing my stuff at the Freshie and the Dunkin' Donuts? Anyway, you get the vibe that it's the same thing. When I go in the bagel place and they're singing, there's some Shawn Mendes, I'll start humming along, get a little sway going in my shoulders, and I'll be like singing it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I can't what about you. And he is at that point now, he's 12 years old, where he gets embarrassed.
Oh, yeah.
Before, he thought it was kind of funny that I would be.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, having attention thrown at me over some goofy dance or something like that. But now he's just like, what are you doing? Do you not understand societal norms? Keep to yourself. Keep your head down. Move to the left. Pay and get out. Why are you infatuated with Shawn Mendes?
Why are you doing this to annoy him?
At first I do it because I'm kind of like just into the song. The group, but then I see how it annoys him, and then I do it more. Right, that's what you're at the point where I don't mind singing. If he's at this point, and you get it, you know, we've all been there, where someone's walking past you and you don't want to be embarrassing. So I don't care if someone's walking past and they think it's kind of funny if I'm singing along to a top 40 song in my head.
This is the kind of stuff he's going to remember. He's not going to remember the weather, but he's going to remember Dad singing in the Freshie.
Singing Shawn Mendes. Remember Shawn Mendes? It'll be our thing. That song will come on. I'll go, I remember when my dad embarrassed me. I really belt it out, too. Really get into it. Try to step back from the line, do a couple shimmies. Get right back in there. Hit the falsetto. Everything is sunny and I can't have you. Nailed it. Who wouldn't want a dad like me? All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Marge Halperin about the South Loop. Our latest in our neighborhood tour, we're trying to hit all 77 neighborhoods. The South Loop, of course, one of the biggest in Chicago. So we'll talk about that neighborhood and what it's like to live down there and what's happening, some of the challenges that that neighborhood is facing when it comes to every development, crime, all the things that every Chicago neighborhood has to deal with. So we'll have that conversation at Akira's Praline Candy, A Taste of New Orleans on South State Street. This place is amazing. We'll have a conversation there coming up after the 8:30 news. Stay with us. It is 720 WGN, and this is Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago, less of a city and more of a collection of little towns. But we don't call them towns. We call them neighborhoods. Tonight, we continue our tour of Chicago neighborhoods with the South Loop. Born in the shadows of Loop skyscrapers, the South Loop is a massive neighborhood, stretching from Harrison to the north, all the way to Cermak to the south. And east-west, you go from the lake all the way to the Dan Ryan Expressway. The neighborhood is exploding. I guess it's new, but the actual neighborhood, it's not. Filled with rich history of Vice and Al Capone, to great mansions, think Marshall Field and Potter Palmer, to great institutions like Soldier Field and the Field Museum, even Motor Row, the South Loop is a walking Chicago history lesson. But in recent years, those relics have kind of been pushed to the side for high-rises and condo development. Columbia College has expanded their footprint, and new buildings and businesses have sprouted up everywhere. Politically, it's the Third Ward. Alderman Pat Dowell's in charge, but the South Loop is home to several notable Chicago leaders. At one time, former Mayor Richard M. Daley lived off Roosevelt and State Street in a gated community. But this neighborhood is a poster child for many Chicagoans who have moved to the area from their single-family houses in the suburbs and outlying neighborhoods to be closer to the action. One of those is my friend Marge Halperin.
Marge is well known to WGN TV viewers as a regular on election night. She's a political consultant and a Chicago booster. She turned in the keys to a house in Ravenswood Manor to come down to this neighborhood. The South Loop hasn't looked back. Where to meet? How about Akira's Praline Candy? It's a New Orleans-inspired cafe at 1845 South State Street. Aaron has had the place for a couple of years and is bringing a real taste of the Big Easy to Chicago with all sorts of great food and drink. If you go, try the beignets. That's what we had, and I'm still thinking about them. Akira's is a perfect place to sit in the window and watch the South Loop traffic fly by. Marge, good to see you.
Hi, and nice to be here.
Thanks for welcoming us to the South Loop. Why'd you choose this place?
Akira's is a classic kind of coffee shop. There's nothing Starbucks-y about it. There's nothing, you know, big box about it. It's not a casual cup of coffee, although it could be quick service. But it's a place that you can come in the neighborhood and see other neighbors.
That's
which
great.
Which is kind of what a neighborhood is about.
It's got the Mardi Gras kind of thing. Do small businesses do well in the South Loop? Is there a space for places like this to grow and develop in this neighborhood?
I certainly hope so. It would be a sad place to live if that were not true. And some parts of the neighborhood have been more successful than others. If you go just west on Roosevelt, it's every chain store you could imagine, whether it's a grocery store, a Target, or a Loft,
right.
Or Gap, or, you know, they're all over there. But this side of the northern end of South Loop, if that makes sense, the east side of South Loop has more storefronts. There's a great little women's accessory and clothing shop across the street from me in the 1200 block of Michigan called Annie's. And Annie usually sits there and welcomes you, and she's got really cool hats and gloves and jewelry, and that she handpicks herself.
I always think about this neighborhood because I went to Columbia College, and I always know that to be the South Loop. But really, if you think about it, that's the, I guess that a lot of the building and the residents are much more south. Here we are sitting at a little 18th and Archer, essentially, mm-hmm. Archer and State Street. But this is a pretty big area to say the South Loop, because even we came up on Indiana and there's all the condos back there. I mean, it's really hard to say there's one place for the South Loop. It's a massive neighborhood.
Right. And that's part of why I also thought it would be fun to come down here. We could have gone to the Starbucks. Actually, you can't go to the Starbucks in Roosevelt anymore because they've taken all the seating out. They just want you to buy your coffee and leave.
Right.
They don't want you to sit and hang around. But there might have been somewhere else up there. But at any rate, yeah, and it even goes just a little bit west. We're really from Printer's Row, which sometimes is considered part of the South Loop, through the Prairie District. And I think generically, I consider it all South Loop. In each neighborhood, you have to ask them where they think they are.
Yeah, right. Well, when I come down here, I'm always being somewhat of a Chicago history nerd. This neighborhood has got so much of it. I mean, to think about what this once was, and to think about even just, you know, the big hotels that were down here in the Al Capone era, but then you've also got, like, so many, like you said, the Prairie District and all the housing. This neighborhood has gone through so much that at one point it was considered a loop, and it was skyscrapers, and now it's more of a booming residential area. Our neighbors and you in particular, are you connected to that history? Do you feel it? Chicago history?
Yeah, sure. You walk through the neighborhood, and there's the old mansions on Prairie Street and Indiana, the Glessner House and Clark House that have been redone and managed by the city as museums, which are gorgeous. You can't help but miss that part of the neighborhood and the history of it. And I've lived in the city not all my life, but all my adult life. And this area was very different when we first moved here in the late 70s. And I might never have imagined living here, but it's a vibrant neighborhood and diverse. And things are happening here, and I'm glad to be here.
There are a lot of things happening here. And there was just 1 or 2 years ago, there were cranes all over the South Loop. And there are plans, whether you go to Chinatown, where the 78 is being proposed and started. I think they're getting close to starting on that. But you also have the One Central, which is the big mm-hmm. proposed idea of a new development in this area. There are a lot of development eyes on this neighborhood. How do you react to that? Is the neighborhood scared? Are they excited? I mean, there's some big plans for down here.
Uneasy and sometimes angry because, you know, the city has had this recent history of mega developments without enough community input. and Mayor Lightfoot has said this will be different, and we intend, you know, to hold her to that. But the two projects here are different. 78 and 1 Central are different. 78 is on vacant rail land where there's not a lot of nearby residential area, but there is some, and they've had a lot of input. They had input in where to put the CTA station, and the elected officials were responsive to the community there. 1 Central just sort of popped up with an overnight deal in Springfield for the state to fund a transportation hub, which is critical to that development. They wouldn't develop there without it. They're pretending that the community is calling for it, but we're not. Amtrak is not. Metro's not.
Now, this would be right by Soldier Field, right?
It would be. It would go south to, from Soldier Field south to 35th Street. And you talked about high rises used to be in the South Loop. Well, they'd be here again. Their initial drawing, which they claim is for conversation, discussion purpose only, has 8 or 9 high rises in it. So they're looking to extend. And when they talk to the city, they'll talk about extending the city skyline. When they talk to the neighborhood, they say, we don't know what'll go there. It's whatever you want, which I don't believe for a minute.
And I think, I wonder, because the rest of the city sees maybe a development fight in residents of the South Loop and a big mega development, like, okay, well, you live in the South Loop. Meaning this is known as a mega development. There's none of this stuff was here 20 years ago. Right. So what do you say to people who might be like, you know what? What's more, 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 8 more high rises?
Yeah, well, development is fine and to be expected. But regional planning is a critical factor that has been left out. If you even to the point where the 78 has got community input, we in the middle are going to be part of a mega development sandwich between 1 Central to our east and 78 to the west, not to mention the second NEMA tower that is supposed to go up but hasn't gone through final approval on the corner of Michigan and Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. There's one tower. They want it to be a twin tower, 70-some stories high.
Wow.
So with seven, I think the one that just completed is rental. The next one would be condo, 700-plus units per, 14 stories of parking for that unit alone. Where are those people going to walk? That's where we may need to expand the transportation hub we have on Roosevelt. What's the capacity for all those new residents, and how will we manage an influx? I don't even know if the sidewalks are wide enough.
Like, you don't even think about those things, right? Right.
And I don't. That's the discussion that doesn't happen.
This neighborhood, I've always loved. Like I said, I went to Columbia College. I remember it also. You know, it'd be you could find a cheaper place to park. Because you'd park in an abandoned lot to go to the Bears game, to walk over the bridge. How's the relationship with the Bears? You know, like when Bears fans come through here in the South Loop, is it good for the neighborhood? Is it kind of like Wrigleyville where it's good and bad? Like, do you recognize and see Bears traffic or museum campus traffic in this neighborhood?
I wouldn't pretend to speak for anyone but myself on this. I think if you want to see how the community feels, you could go to Hello South Loop and find any of the complainers about any of those things.
Our Facebook page,
but,
I'm sure.
Yeah, that's the neighborhood Facebook page, and we get lots of great information. You'll see Akira's on there all the time because we all love to recommend that. There's a lot of good information, but yeah, I mean, you know Soldier Field's here. It's been here as long as any resident,
sure, yeah,
I would
right.
dare say, as they have the museums. Lollapalooza, you know, a lot of people leave town for the weekend. I think it's fun. I often go. I didn't go this year, but I'm happy to go. But even if I don't, it's kind of fun. In the neighborhood, you have an influx of people who are supporting businesses in the neighborhood, which we care about, and just bringing more people to enjoy the city, whether it's through Bears game or concert in Grant Park or whatever.
Yeah.
I personally think that's part of the excitement of living here. If I wanted to avoid crowds, I would live, you know, downstate.
I don't know if it's because the click-through rate or the newspapers, but a lot of times you'll see the South Loop, whenever there's any sort of petty crime down here, it seems like the papers cover it, you know, whether it be some sort of carjacking or some sort of crime. It could be a violent crime. How is the crime in the South Loop? I don't understand if this is an area that people are coming down to try and rustle up trouble, or do you not see criminal elements here?
Well, it does happen here. I'm not sure it happens here more than in other neighborhoods, and a whole lot less than many, as we know. Sadly, there are neighbors not too far
from
us.
And you have the police station right over here, too.
Yeah, there's a new police station. Yeah. And the police presence is good when it needs to be, and when we have these events like Bears or concerts or other things, Rolling Stones or whatever, you'll see the police all over. They manage traffic, they manage crowd control, and they block streets as needed. You know, when we have the marathon down here, I can't actually get out of my driveway because the street is blocked in both ends. You have to get out and move the sawhorse and drive past and put it back. So there's that kind of thing.
That's very Chicago. Move the sawhorse on marathon day.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're trapped in your, or walk to the train.
So it's pretty similar in other neighborhoods you've lived in Chicago.
I think so. Yeah. And when there's crime, the neighborhoods, you know, the neighbors will spread the word, and we're on the lookout and concerned about it. You know, they're like over Christmas last year, north of us into Grant Park, it was like holiday package theft and related to people shopping with money around the holidays and that kind of thing. And there was more police present. Columbia College stationed people out on Michigan Avenue, which was very supportive, and we appreciated that for their students and for the residents. So there are some of those things that didn't happen when I lived in Ravenswood, you know, for example. Wasn't a holiday shopping.
Right.
Again, those stores were here when I moved here, so.
Politically, when you talk about this neighborhood, the South Loop, and does it have a lot of clout in city council, the alderman who represents here and this neighborhood? Because it's so new. You know, I think about some of the inner city neighborhoods like the West Loop or the South Loop, where they may be growing exponentially, but do they have the sort of political muscle that some of the old school neighborhoods have, like a Bridgeport or even a Lincoln Park, if you will? But does the South Loop represent well when it comes to the city and state politics?
I'm compelled to note that with all the turnover in city council, there aren't many neighborhoods that have that kind of deep-seated power anymore. Even the 14th, about to lose theirs, so perhaps. But Alderman Dowell has been in the council. She has some longevity there, and she's gotten good standing and has a committee appointment that I just forgot what it was.
That's okay.
She's got...
You're a concerned citizen if you know what your alderman and what committee she serves on. I'm not sure I can tell you everyone that my alderman serves on.
No, but it is one of influence, I will tell you that. So she's comfortable with the new administration, and that's good, and has been responsive to the community. Now, our ward extends, it's a long strip that runs from north to south. And so the South Loop, part of it, not the same as the southern end, you know, different needs, different kinds of population, so different issues. And so she has to balance a funny kind of strip of a ward in that way.
Marge, is this the kind of place, you've been here for a shorter amount of time than the other neighborhoods you've lived in, but do you see this as a place you're going to stay? I mean, is the South Loop... Is it transient, or is it a space that you're saying, you know what, this is where I'm going to spend the rest of my life?
For me, I think so. My husband and I moved here after raising our children on the north side and in a big house that we don't need anymore, with two cars that we don't need anymore. So part of it is to come here and have a simpler life. We live in a high rise, which is an easier life, never have in my life, but I like that when we want to travel, you close the door and walk away. And if you forget to stop the newspapers, yes, I still have newspapers. It doesn't really matter. They pile up in front of the door. Nobody really cares. If you know, the people take care of packages when they arrive and that kind of thing. So the convenience is both about the neighborhood and the choice that I made about where to live. Mm-hmm. But it's I don't know a lot of neighborhoods like this where it would be diverse, vibrant. I like that it's developing. I don't want it to be overrun by mega developments, but I like that things are happening here and also convenient to downtown and other places. And it is simpler. We take mass transit most of the time because the trains are so convenient. And we like that.
Marge Halperin telling us about her neighborhood, the South Loop. We continue our Chicago neighborhood tour. Well, still got plenty to go, but we've done probably 25, 30 of them. If you want to go to wgnradio.com/extension720, you can find them all. We continue. Stay with us.
still thinking of those beignets. Akira's Praline Candy, which is, Aaron tells us, the owner says it's the only place that goes that deep on New Orleans cuisine. That, because you'll have Heaven on 7 and kind of the vibe about dinner, but these is more about pralines, coffee, beignets.
Yeah, let's do a broadcast there for Fat Tuesday next year.
There you go. The secret to a great beignet has to be the temperature and the massive powdered sugar, right? So the beignet is hot. It's like a nice warm. It can be too hot. And then you put that in the mouth, and it's like the sugar almost sticks to your teeth. That's a good beignet. It
definitely sticks to your lips.
Yeah, right? If you want to see what Akira's looks like, or the old cow path, or any of the stuff that we talk about, you know, obviously we've been doing a radio show here, but you can check it out at Instagram at WGN Radio. Pete puts up all the photos of the show and video and whatever else we took when we're out there. So check that out on our Instagram page, WGN Radio. Sound good? Sounds good. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about water parks. I've been to Raging Waves. This is the place we're talking with Gary. I've been to that one a couple years ago. It's out in Yorkville. It's a pretty good trek from downtown Chicago, but it's massive. It's huge, and so many. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, you stand in that line, you know, to go up on the big tube water slide.
Yeah,
and not unlike roller coasters. And I guess this is just a function of the culture and society we live in. But somehow we've determined that standing in long lines to do something that takes 20 seconds is of value. Right? It always blows my mind how long you wait in for a roller coaster.
Yeah.
At Great America, and you're like, I'm waiting for an hour, and then it takes what, 40 seconds?
My wife always tells me about like trips that she's taken to New York to go see some art installation where she'd have to wait 4 hours to sit in a dark room for 20 seconds.
I'm like, really? You're like Kusama, right? I've done that.
What are we doing?
Exactly. The value proposition. It's the equation, the formula. Where you're just like, I don't understand it. And I have such a hard time. I don't know if it's just the way I'm wired or raised or whatever it is, but I'm like, does not compute. But then again, I think about the experience of a roller coaster or the experience of a water slide in any form, and they stay with you. So it's not necessarily about the 30 seconds that you spent. The value and the memory that is associated to that stays with you. I can tell you about riding the Eagle or you know, the old Great America ride.
The Whizzer.
Or the Whizzer.
The Demon.
Or the Demon. Or I can remember certain water slides and thrills that you don't necessarily remember the line that it took to get to the top and get on the tube, but you do remember, like, I'm going to fall out of it. Or that dunking sensation when you actually get to the end of the ride. Anyway, for the Downtown Chicago business, we're talking about water parks. We're talking about Raging Waves in Yorkville and what it takes from an entrepreneur stand to create and maintain and manage a water park in the Chicago area. So we'll have that conversation coming up on Extension 720. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Welcome to the Download on Chicago Business. I'm Justin Kaufman here for 720 WGN. Well, when you think summer businesses, the one business that comes to mind has to be water parks. Well, you wouldn't necessarily think of that as an entrepreneurial idea, but it is for Randy Witt and Raging Waves, which is the great water park out in Yorkville. Randy, thanks for being here and being my guest on Download on Chicago Business.
Well, thank you for having me.
How do you get into the water park business?
Yeah, I tell you, it was a long time in the making. It was a dream come true. You just kind of get bit by the water park bug, as somebody described it to me a number of years ago, and it's so true. You just start thinking about it and realizing, and then you visit parks and you realize even more, and then pretty soon you're realizing an actual water park.
Well, I think about the Chicagoland area, and we've been blessed to have good water parks all over the place for years. I think of up in Rockford, and I think it was Cherry Valley in that area. But for Raging Waves, you come in and you become the sort of granddaddy quickly in this market. How do you do that? How do you become the destination water park in a big metropolitan area like Chicago?
Yeah, great point. We stayed the course. That is what we did. we had this vision that we wanted to be a big water park. It had to be all-encompassing, something for the entire family to do. You spend a day there. You don't just come there for an hour. You're bored. Got to get the heck out of there. It's something that we wanted to build really, really big, really just very substantial. And so we stayed the course on that, and we just kept building upon it and improving it. And now, as after these many years, as things have matured as far as landscaping and development of different buildings and things like that, that is how we really, really made it work and what we are to this day.
You know, running a water park in the summer in the Chicagoland area is a pretty simple concept. I mean, people really want to seek it out. But it is a seasonal business. This is not the area of the country that has round-the-clock 365-day water parks. So from that point of view, is it hard and a challenge to be a businessman who runs a water park when you can only do it for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, it really is. We've got 90 days to make it. We've got Memorial Day to Labor Day, and everything, I've told people this before, everything rises and falls on raging waves. If I had five water parks scattered throughout the country, if one doesn't do good, the other picks the other one up. We don't have that. I mean, it's raging waves, period. So it is a challenge. We face a lot of challenges, obviously, with weather. When the weather's great, people flock there. When the weather's pretty good, we still get pretty good crowds. And we're seeing that grow and grow and grow. So that's helpful. But I'll tell you, the biggest thing that kills us is not so much the weather, it's the forecast. When the forecast comes out and there's, you know, X amount of percentage, whether it's 40 for 50% chance of rain that day, it kills our day. It just kills it. And there's so, so many days. I can't tell you how many days that just never materializes. But you got to deal with it.
Yeah. You know, the other issue with this business in particular, when you're talking about amusement parks or in this case, water parks, safety comes to mind. There's so many regulations that go around water temperature and making sure that everybody is safe on the actual rides. There's a lot that goes into that if you're a businessman in this area.
Yeah, there's three tenets we build Raging Waves around. That's the cleanliness, the friendliness, but most importantly, the safety. You have to be safe. There's just no compromise there. So yeah, we are heavily regulated, which we welcome. We made a decision a long time ago because we're required to do pool checks once in the AM, once in the PM. We did away with that. We do them every hour on the hour. We hire pool techs. And right now, as we speak, they monitor each pool, and it takes them about 45 to 50 minutes to do a round for each pool, and then they start all over again. And we do that every hour of every single day we're
open. This is the download in Chicago business. So when you think about what would be the overhead when there's heavy regulation on a business like this, and, you know, when safety, and that means staff, and that means making sure everybody's trained up, I would assume the expenses start to pile up. I mean, there really is, and you only have 90 days to make it.
Yeah.
It's a challenging industry.
It really is, yeah. And that's a great point. It's much more challenging than I thought. When I'm dreaming about it, and I'm visiting these parks and seeing all the crowds, what I wasn't seeing was those days where the forecast was bad or the weather was bad and there was only 100 people in the park. So, yeah, it is very challenging, but you got to be very efficient. You got to be very shrewd, wise, and you just got to really utilize your resources to the fullest extent.
You know, I always think of water parks not unlike theme parks. They have this balance of making sure that the aficionados, the thrill seekers, if you will, are satisfied, and the families that want to make sure they're having a good time. How do you do that with the water park? Because I would assume, not unlike a place like Great America or other places, you need something every year that's going to be new or interesting or unique that's going to grab maybe a thrill seeker to come out.
Yeah, absolutely. So we start off with our original park or the original rides, the attractions, if you will. We took into account like what members of the family can do this. And we wanted to go from the toddlers to the grandparents. And so we went all the way through that and discovered that any rides we can do where multiple members of the family can ride together was really, really popular. So we tried that. So yeah, so we have this thrill seeking segment. We have the wave pool segment. We have a brand new kiddie area that we're so excited about. And it's but I'm going to brag a little bit. We're being nominated for the kiddie area, the new kiddie area of the year award. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're excited about that. And then, but as I mentioned, then we have the regular staple of rides, and then we have the thrill rides for the thrill seekers is all.
What have you learned? How have you evolved as a guy runs the water park, Ranging Waves? What have you learned in the time that you've done it?
Yeah. Oh, boy. I've learned, I've learned patience. I've learned tolerance. And I've learned that some people that come into your park, they don't care as much about your park as keeping it nice as you do. So there's a lot of places that we've learned over the year that you have to kind of people-proof the park and just kind of make it a little more, where you can control things a little better.
Because I would assume people, because they pay the ticket price up front, they see the park as disposable in the way that they can say, I'm just going to throw my trash here. I can eat and leave my tray, or I can go and leave the inner tube here. Like, there seems to be a lack of etiquette is what you're saying.
Oh, my goodness. Were you there yesterday? Yeah, you nailed it. Every one of those points, you nailed it. So, yeah. So you learn patience. You learn, you know, that you just, this is your job. You learn very quickly that, you know, you've got to clean up after people. You've got to watch after them. But really what you learn is you got to provide a great, safe, you got to make them happy. I'm telling you, if you can make them happy, you've done your job.
One of the issues I always think about with theme parks and water parks in particular is that for you to be successful, you need that line around the block, or you need that line to get onto the popular ride, right? You see this all the time. And that's good for you and your business. Not necessarily great for me, who has to stand in a 45-minute line to take a water slide for 10 seconds or whatever it might be. How do you balance that to make sure that it's not too overcrowded or too popular and gives everybody that kind of experience?
Yeah, that's hard. But okay, one of the balances we do is you have the we have a huge wave pool and a big lazy river. So we always tell people, listen, if you don't want to wait in lines now, you can always go and get wet. That's what we've learned. You asked earlier about what we've learned. Another thing, people just want to get wet. They want to come to your park. They want to get wet, whether it's a slide, the river, the wave pool. So we tell them, hey, you don't want to wait in lines right now? Get in the wave pool. Enjoy that for a while. And then as we've grown, we've added more attractions. And we've seen how when we add attractions, that kind of lessens the weight on the other rides, because there's just more to do. You're just spreading the crowd out more with more attractions. So that's really how we combat that.
So take us back to the minute when you said, I want to get into Raging Waves. It's been a couple of years now. Would you do the same thing again? I mean, if you were the same guy with a dream and you were thinking about water parks and now you know what you know now, would you do it again?
You know, if you'd asked me that 6 years ago, I said, no way. I bemoaned the fact that it was hard. People don't care, but it was hard. It was way harder than I thought. You asked me that today, as you just did. Yeah, I would do it again. I would do it again. I tell people we're not great, but life is a lot better than it used to be. It is better, and it's going in the right direction, and that we're so grateful for that.
The Raging Waves Water Park is out in Yorkville, and Randy Witt is the owner. Randy, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about what it takes to run a water park.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. We've got a show tomorrow night and Friday night. Gosh, excited to be back in the saddle. Not that I don't mind the summer hours. but you know, Pete and I keep ourselves busy, as you can hear with some of the stuff in the 8 o'clock hour. We're getting out and around. That's one of the, we want to be the hallmarks of the new Extension 720, is that we get out in this beautiful city and surrounding area. Do stories actually where the stories take place. And you can hear that tomorrow night and the night after. Tomorrow night, I'm excited. Mike Patrician's going to be here. He is the founder of Riot Fest. Riot Fest, of course, I would say the final music festival of the summer. It happens the second week of September. You're going to have the Jazz Fest coming up Labor Day weekend. And then the final one is Riot Fest, which is out in Douglas Park. Douglas Park was the
site of shooting this weekend, which was on the west side where seven people were shot. But yeah, Riot Fest takes over Douglas Park, I think the second week of September. But yeah, Mike Patrician, who came in and graciously gave us his time when we were on the download, and he was a guest at the Big Table. We used to do that segment. He's back in studio tomorrow night. Always great, right? And they got a great lineup. You look at some of the great punk rock bands that are coming through. If you're at all a fan of punk rock music, Blink-182, Jawbreaker, The Descendants, there are a lot of great bands that are coming through that are going to play that festival. And they've been able to be an independent music festival when it seems like most of the music festivals are owned by corporations.
Yeah.
Not, you know, obviously what we just saw at Lollapalooza. And you heard Don saying that they're still closed roads. Columbus is still closed as they're cleaning up from Lollapalooza. So Grant Park and the surrounding roads have not been in service since what, the Monday or Tuesday before Lollapalooza to now?
What are they cleaning?
There's a lot of glitter.
And it's tough to get off.
Yeah. Think of all the basketball jerseys that were left behind, the short shorts. It's hard to get off. Like, I can't get this glitter up. It's going to be another day. Columbus is going to be closed for another day. I got to get this glitter up. Yeah, I always, you know, I try. Like, we talked about this last week, especially on the podcast we do, Lower Wacker Live, which you can find at WGNRadio.com. I'm trying not to be such a grandpa curmudgeon when it comes to Lollapalooza, but it does really, I don't know, it disrupts a lot of the Chicago routine where they have this festival is magical to have a festival of that size with hundreds of thousands of people, 4 days, to come down and have the backdrop be the skyline of Chicago. When you're standing there listening to your favorite band and you look back and you see the skyline behind, there's nothing better in music. There is nothing better. But the cost, the disruption of the routine, we're stuck in a little bit of that traffic around Michigan Avenue, Lakeshore Drive, obviously cutting off Columbus, that has an impact. And then just the concept that it takes the city 2.5-3 weeks to clean up Grant Park, you know, that it's closed off to the public. I don't know. It feels like, you know, build something at Michael Reese and call it Lollapalooza Way over the tracks there and make it happen.
We were talking about perhaps, you know, we take our, you've already done it, take the annual trip to the South Side for the Vito Nix, Rainbow Cone, you know, double whammy. Mm-hmm. And we're like, no, I can't do it. Can't go that. You can't go past Grant Park.
Right.
You just can't do it.
So not unlike
deal with it.
Today.
So Rainbow Cone, you are out $5.
You're out. See, there's an impact. It's not unlike the cycle of life that, you know, there is a butterfly effect that Rainbow Cone didn't make their nut tonight or the other night because you didn't want to deal with Lollapalooza traffic.
Like, conversely, there's people on the south side that were like, hey, let's head up north and go to Pequod's. And they say, ah, screw that. Let's go to
No one's calculating this data. There's so much data about how much is brought in from the economy from Lollapalooza, but no one has the Pete Zimmerman data about how they decided not to do something because of the fact. You know, Lollapalooza down there.
I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on this project.
This could be your big data drop. Yeah. You know, Zimmerman research, and you can go on all the radio stations across the country and talk about, you know, they always talk about how much the festival brings in, but how much money was lost? Well, researcher Pete Zimmerman says it's the hidden costs, like not wanting to leave your living room. I think you're onto something, man. We do a whole show on Zimmerman data. We got to do that, right? You should come up with like 5 or 6 data-driven things that you want to prove, and then we'll do a whole extension 720 trying to prove them with the data you've collected.
I'm sure we would have stopped at Beverly Records.
Right.
They lost, you know, $3 or $4 on a used record. This adds up.
It does. You could have got a side of guacamole at the place that you used to get. Where's that at? Pepe's.
Not a side. I would get it as my meal.
Yeah, right. You'd get the side. That would be your meal.
Yeah.
That's a $3.50. They're out $3.50. Good stuff. Zimmerman Research coming to your way on Extension 720. This is a download. Oh, geez, you hear that? Fell right back into the old patterns. I think we're just talking about the download and Mike Patrician. But this is Extension 720. Download's the old show. See that? Right behind me right now, I can see in the reflection as I look at Pete for forgiveness for my gaffe, I can see the fireworks going off in the distance here at 303 Wacker. We're just right where they launched the fireworks that you could see every Wednesday and Saturday. So it's nice to be here in the studio. We're not always here on Wednesdays because of White Sox baseball, but to be here tonight and to broadcast to the Chicago area with fireworks in the background, come on. You don't get that every day. You especially don't get that in February. They're not doing the they're not launching fireworks in February. So, Pete, I wanted to ask you about the eggplant. Has there been a summer of eggplants? I mean, are you getting a what seems to be a routine of eggplant drops?
Yeah, we had one a couple of weeks ago. A couple of weeks ago, another one. Same thing, under a bush in front of our house, and marked with like the A or whatever. What did we decide? It wasn't the A.
It was a symbol.
Some sort of symbol on the eggplant.
So this was a big mystery when we both were working on the Cochrane show and tried to unpack it, and we had people call in. And we had said that, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to use our resources and our investigative skills to get to the bottom of this, and we have yet to even think about it. But this continues to happen. And what we decided is that symbol, it was like an A that almost wasn't closed, like a line kind of went through it, as a Wiccan symbol for bounty or for good health. It actually may not be a threatening gesture that people are dropping off eggplants in your front yard, but instead something that is
the
Wiccan tradition of offering and some sort of good tiding.
And we had engineer Bill gave me a camera to mount on our front steps, and I just stopped doing it. It was because, like, you'd have to change it every day. You'd have to I kind of had it tied up weirdly. It didn't look right. My wife didn't like the way it looked on the front, so we haven't caught anybody, but there's been one. And then we have new neighbors to our right, and we kind of, at this point, we just kept it out there. Like in the past, I've like picked it up, I brought it to work, them out. I just kept it out there, and actually, from the previous eggplant was an eggplant was surrounded by a bunch of black beans, and we just left the beans out there. The beans are now, it's a nice bean plant.
Oh, look at that!
Yeah,
so maybe that was the gardening. Whole point, right? Yeah. Now you have food.
So we had left it out there, and we noticed that a couple of days ago it was gone, and we were thinking, oh no, did the our new neighbors see this and dispose of it, or did they think we put it there? It's like an added mystery. And then this morning we saw another one on the house to the left.
So now, okay. So this was something that was, we were thinking you were being targeted individually because your neighbors hadn't had this happen, but now new neighbors are getting the same treatment.
Although we're not certain if it's the same eggplant. I don't know if like somebody took the one that was on the next to our neighbor on the right to,
you know, said they're screw these guys
and then put it on the other neighbors,
or if it's a new eggplant.
It didn't really get a good eye.
Wow.
On the eggplant.
So it's someone who is offering this as a gesture to the new neighbors in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And I believe my wife's running club, the world-renowned Glenn's running group, they're investigative reporters.
Investigative. You could say investigative. You don't have to feel pretentious about it. You can say investigative. It's one of my favorite words to say. Investigative.
They caught a marathon cheater. You know, they're into solving these mysteries. So when they found out that there was
season two of trying to figure out mysteries, they got the marathon cheater for the first season.
Yeah, first season. Of
season
marathon.
Two, they're on the eggplants. Yeah,
and they came up with the same thing that you did. It was kind of, it's
like a welcoming
offer. It's nothing ominous. It is a welcoming.
So the idea,
we've
though,
been there for a couple. We've been right, there for been almost the, 3 years.
Right. Maybe they just keep thinking you're new.
I don't talk much to the people. I don't talk much to the neighbors.
So you have to. The one thing I would say about this story is that they have to have a plethora of eggplant. And we kind of determined they're going to the store and buying these.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we said because of the way they looked. And they're kind of that purple, overtly purple, you know, shoot the extra purple into the produce at the Jewel. So, but they're now, I mean, those are expensive. You know, so these people are dropping eggplant after eggplant now.
Yeah.
Doubling up on their expenses.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it's somebody, could it be possible that somebody works at the Jewel, you know, who's like, oh, I'm going to pocket these.
They get the 20% discount.
Yeah, they drop it and this one's dropped, it's damaged.
Or they're day olds.
Yeah, and they throw them in the back, but they kind of like, this is what I used to do at the, when I worked at the Omni, which you could get away with is like, I'm going to take this stuff back. And then the one just kind of rolls away from the, you know, the can or whatever. And then you can circle around to the back and grab that Snickers bar, whatever it was.
Are you serious?
I'm not even sure I ever did that.
That was in lore.
But I feel like that was something I would have done. Like, I feel like that would be, yeah, that would be kind of like, there's nothing worse than being the guy who's in charge of the throwaways, the one day olds, and then also kind of like looking both ways and be like, no one's around. I'm going to take a bite of this peach. See what's up.
When I worked at the, can't even remember the name of the banquet hall in Bridgeview. I can't remember the name of it, but after the wedding, you know, I'd bust the wedding, and then when you'd go and get your paycheck or whatever for that night, or tips or something, I can't remember. But the rolls, they had all, like, whatever people, the rolls that people didn't eat.
You could have those?
You could have those. I don't know what happened to them while they were on the plate. I don't know if somebody took, you know, but there were such a bags and bags of rolls.
And
I would just, like, grab, like, a couple of rolls, just eat them on my walk
home. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, man. When I worked in college, I worked in the cafe that was in the college, like, you know, where the center, the Hokin Center, whatever it is. And I worked in a coffee shop and it had sandwiches in the back. And you'd have to get the sandwiches for lunch, you know, and do the whole bit. But at the end of the night, that stuff, you know, deli meat can't stick around. It's a one-day offering. Then they bring the new stuff the next day. So that I lived off of that stuff, like the almost day-old deli, for 2 years. Like this idea that I would make some sandwich and then take it home and then I would eat that sandwich at home. So I'm eating like the turkey and roast beef that was in those little rolls that was probably brought over there at 7 a.m. and I'm chowing down at 10 p.m. But I lived off that stuff. That was,
so yeah, just like, you're alive.
Yeah. And I'm alive. And frankly, I didn't feel like I was really stealing from that. They were kind of cool with it because they're like, you're going to throw this stuff out anyway.
Exactly.
I feel like they were giving back to the community and I was the community. College kid who was like, how are you making enough money? I mean, also, I think I was getting paid $6 an hour or something like that at that point. So I think it money helped. Stretch because I got that turkey and cheese.
Starbucks did the same thing. You know, at that night, whatever those day things that didn't sell, they're throwing them out. And I'd get frustrated. I'm like, well, shouldn't we just let's bring these to, you know, some starving people. This is such a waste.
It's such a waste.
Let's do it. And I think I did it for like one day. I'm like, I'm going to bring this on the train and I'm going to give these out to the homeless. And then I did it for a day. And then I was like,
that was one of my duties too. I was on the night shift and it was when I was at Columbia College and you had been speaking of South Loop. I think the moment in which the South Loop changed. So the South Loop used to have on State Street the Pacific Garden Mission, a famous mission, of course. They had the sign, the Christ died for your sins sign, neon sign right there on State and Harrison, and right by the Red Line stop there. And that would be where the homeless would come to get shelter at night, and there were only a certain amount of beds, so the homeless would line up. And it was my job at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, when it was over, I'd walk over the hard bagels. Like the day olds, everything that was left over, you know, after I made my turkey and cheese and everything else to go. And you would go in there and there'd be it'd be bustling. There'd be a ton of stuff. But at the South Loop at that time, and I'm talking about probably the mid 90s, maybe like 1994, 1995, it was pretty down and out. meaning there wasn't a lot of development there. Mm-hmm. There weren't a lot. No one was living down there. There were yet to be dorms for Columbia College, and there was a really vibrant homeless population because you don't go far from those beds at the Pacific Garden Mission because it's first come, first serve, and there's only a specific amount. So the homeless stayed in the South Loop, and they would just kind of camp out in front of Columbia College and other spots right there. And it would, and they're doing the same thing. They moved the mission probably mid-2000s. They closed that, and they moved the mission to Canal Street beyond the Jewel and that sort of area that Marjorie's talking about. That's all just development and, every cookie-cutter store. And you see it now. And that I'm sure the West or the South Loop boards are talking about this, that there's an extreme homeless issue in the parking lot at Jewel, Jerry's Deli or whatever it is. There's a deli, like a Ben's Deli or something, and there's a GameStop and a Domino's and Jewel, and the homeless just hang out there all day in the summer. They're just in that lot. So if you're going to Jewel to go shopping, there are five or six people that are like sleeping right there. And it's not because, again, they don't want to go far from where the beds are going to be at night. So, but when they moved, and they did that on purpose, they moved the Pacific Garden Mission. That became Jones High School, which is now all that shiny new building right there. And after they did that, the development started popping in. People started moving out moving in, and the high rises came in, and the South Loop, as we know it today, was born. So this is interesting. I just to think about that. But yeah, I was in charge of the hard bagels. The hard bagels guy. I'd walk in and be like, "Hey, it's hard bagels guy."
I don't think there's anything that people are very particular about their bagel and food in general. And I'm an old food guy. I don't mind eating a day old leftovers, 2 days, burritos that have been in the refrigerator for 3 days. My wife is like, well, you can have this because that was, we ate that 3 days ago. I'm like, yeah.
She's the human expiration day.
Yeah, right. I like old food.
I like old food. I'm one of those guys like you that it needs to have an effect on me. If I'm eating a 3 or 4 day old thing and I actually get something like a stomach problem from it, then I've learned. Then I know retroactively that was a bad idea. But there's nothing stopping me from doing. Like if I don't get sick from it, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep doing it. All right, we'll take a break. Our last break here. We'll come back and Jerry Nunn's going to come in. He's got the show tonight here, the 10 o'clock show. And we will wrap up Extension 720. So stay with us. Big show tomorrow. We're going to talk, of course, with Mike Patrician from Riot Fest. Also coming up this week, we had a chance yesterday. We went up and interviewed Brandon Hendrickson. Brandon Hendrickson is Mr. Olympia. He's a Chicago kid who at one point turned to bodybuilding, got obsessed with it, continued. He is a champion. He is Mr. Olympia, and he's defending his title in September. He is the full-on real deal Arnold Schwarzenegger muscles like you've never seen. At the end of the interview, the reason we didn't do it live is we did it in his gym on the barbell compound up on the northwest side, like right at the edge of Chicago on the northwest side, 6300 block of Avondale. And I talked to him afterwards. We had a great conversation about why, what goes into this. How do you get to this point? I mean, you see a picture of him, you can Google him. It's crazy. But, we did like the pictures, afterwards so I can get a photo with, Pete so he can put it on Instagram. And I kind of put my arm around him, put it on his shoulder, and I've never felt a shoulder like that in my life. It was the hardest, shoulder of all time. It was shaped in a way that I didn't know shoulders could be shaped. It was... It was outstanding. I was like, oh, my God. I'm like, it would take me 25 years of working out, eating right, and doing all that stuff to have a shoulder that looks like that or feels like that. But I think that I might do it. It's only going to be one shoulder. I'm going to do the right shoulder. This was a little bit off balance, but, yeah, it was great. So we're going to have that conversation coming up. I believe we're going to do it on Friday. Yeah, but it's fun, man. It was fun to go up there. I was tempted to show him what I could do. The one thing I learned – this is from everyone that was up there, including Bill and Bill Crane and Brandon, is that when these guys are lifting weights and doing the free weights, like the big muscle weight stuff, they always do it to check their form in the mirror. I just thought it was vain. I mean, whenever you see anyone in the gym who's actually looking at themselves, their inner monologue's like, I'm too sexy for my... And they said that if you walk in front of them, you'll get a plate thrown at your head.
Yeah, etiquette.
Because they're like, that's etiquette. You don't walk in front of someone who is admiring themselves in the mirror while they're lifting weights, because they're looking at their form and making sure it's correct. And that's a sign of disrespect, and you will get bounced out of the gym.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting, and it made me think about all the times I probably casually was like, is anyone using this machine?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I didn't even think about some guy who was in the gym that I go to that was lifting weights.
I do it at the gym all the time.
Yeah, I feel like I know why people are throwing things at me.
And it's usually like, are you using those 8 pounds?
Can I get by you real quick? I need to get on that one machine that I don't know what it does, but I'm gonna pretend I'm gonna do three sets on it. Oh, this seems right. This is really working my back core. I did it. Time to go. That's essentially how I work out, as fast as I possibly can to get out of that room. I'd be like, I did it. I did something. I'm gone.
I never know at the gym. I never know what things are called.
Yeah.
You know, the proper terminology. Yeah. And then I'll say, like, I went to the gym, and my wife will ask me how it was. I'm like, yeah, we did those things where, you know, I had to work the side bits, you know, because I don't know the proper name of the muscle. Like, it's the bits. You know, we did the side thingies.
We did the side thingies and the side bits. Yeah, so we'll have a conversation with a real weightlifter and a Mr. Olympia, Brandon Hendrickson, that's coming up on Extension 720. And like we said earlier at the top of the story, or the show, another story we're working on, which is going to be a big show about tackling violence in Chicago. We were down at Back of the Yards yesterday, 51st and Troop, talking with Precious Blood Ministries and the Institute for Nonviolence about how they work with kids in that area to get them off the street. And we were had enlightened conversations with them and with the kids as well. And tomorrow, maybe I'm going to come in early. I'm going to go through some of that tape, and maybe we can play some of that tomorrow, maybe from Sister Donna, who actually had transferred to Chicago 15 years ago from Dayton, Ohio. So this is a particularly tough week for her. So we will talk with Sister Donna. We'll air some of that tomorrow night on Extension 720. Jerry's coming up next. Stay with us. That's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. We're back tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Jerry Nunn's up at 10 o'clock here. Jerry, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, too.
All right, what's on the show tonight? How was Lollapalooza, by the way?
Oh, I survived. I'm still recovering. last week I did all kind of music, Lollapalooza stuff.
Yeah.
This week we're doing theater, so we're diving into the theater scene in Chicago. Yeah,
excellent. That's a good scene to dive into.
Yeah, I have some great guests coming in. David Cerda from Hell in a Handbag, which is a super campy, fun. I mean, he's been doing it for a long time.
They do great Christmas stuff, too. Right?
Great. Rudolph the Red Host, Reindeer, a lot of parodies. His Golden Girls show is a big success, so he's going to come in and talk
it's,
about
I did something for a festival one time where we were doing, like, covers, cover sketches and things like that for comedy.
Okay.
And we did a Golden Girls live read.
Oh.
And it is a dirty show.
It is.
Like, when you go back, you're like, they're so great. The actors and that were so great. But when you actually read the script, you're like, it's just sexual innuendo after sexual innuendo.
Oh, Blanche knew how to do it. You know, she's a Southern Belle. So, yes.
It all came from Estelle Getty. She was like that character. Like, she just had one-liner after one-liner.
Yeah,
after
and one-liner. It gets... Because she's the older one, and disguise, she gets by with a lot.
She did. What else you got on the show?
So we also have the artistic producer and a star from Head Over Heels, the musical, which is just got here from New York already. And so that's the Go-Go's music.
Yeah, right on.
So that's going to be fun. We're going to play some Go-Go's music and talk about the show.
I love it. All right.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff coming up.
That's great. Well, Jerry's got you're up till 1. Mike Heideman with you as well.
I know.
Good
I'm
to have
so
Mike
excited.
At night again here. That's always good to have him.
Yeah.
That's right. When he's not playing music. This might actually get in the way of some of the great Instagram stories that you see Mike at every open mic. He's out in Nashville.
I know.
He's playing music.
We got to talk about Nashville.
I was going to say, if this is going to curb all that activity, I don't know if I like Mike at night.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. It'll be fun.
Great. Have a great show, Joe.
All right. Thank you.